Hope you all enjoy this pre-talk entertainment of this little movie. And so I guess I have 1.5 hours,
yeah,
right? If Henry doesn't show up, I have 2.5.
He's been traced. He's been tracked to getting off a plane in Santa Barbara around that point, so he should be here with
okay.
Henry Bourne. Henry Bourne is the next speaker. He's arriving this morning, but he's been tracked en route, so he's doing okay.
GPA. Yeah, wow. So today I'm going to talk about the role of chemoattracting activated signal transduction pathways in regulation of chemotaxis. So I promise I'm not going to show any mathematical equation or any model or mathematical model. So I guess the purpose of my talk is just to give you an idea of the most of the physicists' idea of how a biologist used, especially in our case, a gene targeting approach to identify and characterize the signaling pathway that's important for chemotaxis. So, chemoattractants. Especially the chemoattractants for the leukocyte. There are different cell may respond to a different chemoattractant. When I talk about the chemoattractant, I generally refer to the leukocyte chemoattractant. So the leukocyte chemoattractant consists of a variety of different molecules. For example, it can be a byproduct. From the bacteria, like this tri-amino acid peptide, which probably responsible for the chasing of this bug in the previous movie. This is usually produced by bacteria. And also like a fragment from the complement. The most of the chemoattractants are called chemokines, which produced by cells generally upon injury and infection. There are probably around about 50 genes have been characterized. They share a certain homology. They can be divided into different classes based on the structure feature. So the main function for the leukocyte chemoattractant is to attract and activate the leukocyte. So they are the immediate mediator for inflammatory responses. That's why we are interested in those molecules. Probably the reason may not be a real concern for most of you, but when we write a grant to NIH, we have to justify the importance.
What are those tri-amino acid peptides?
So this is basically methionine, leucine, and phenylalanine. Formula methionine, leucine, and phenylalanine. This is just because the bacteria protein, most of the protein, the first amino acid is has a formula group. So it's distinguished from the mammalian protein. The mammalian protein for the first amino acid, the methionine, does not contain this specific moiety. So that's why this can be a chemoattractant.
It's unique to bacteria.
It's unique to the prokaryotic. No, this is just the most of the bacteria protein that start with this amino acid. So that's why once you have got an infection from bacteria, you're going to have those kind of peptide produced from the bacteria, which serve as a chemoattractant. No, you don't have to be that short. This is common usage. It can be a little bit longer.
This is the top after the macrophages.
No, they have a natural degradation anyway once you get into the host.
Are bacteria known to secrete that tripeptide?
No, actually, most of the bacterial protein start with the formula peptide. You don't have to be LP, the leucine, and the phenylalanine. And this is the most commonly used chemoattractant.
How much of that is secreted by the bacteria?
The bacteria will produce those kind of either. You don't have to secrete this peptide. You can, by any protein is secreted by the bacteria, which could contain a formula methionine with other amino acid follow. And once it chopped to a certain length, it can serve as a chemoattractant for leukocyte. The leukocyte develop a receptor in the evolution which can sense binds to this kind of peptide.
Why should the bacteria secrete?
No, this is not on purpose. So any, that's my point, any of the bacterial protein, okay, contain formylmethionine. The first amino acid is formylmethionine because it's the starting codon. That's methionine. In the mammalian cell, that's just a regular methionine. In the bacteria, it's just modified. It's different from the eukaryotic system. Okay, all these chemoattractants I mentioned above binds to a G-protein coupled receptor. They all share a common structure feature. They all have a semi transmembrane domain. So they all couple to a heterotrimeric G protein consists of three subunits, alpha, beta, and gamma. So the interaction, the ligated receptor will interact with the heterotrimeric G protein and basically promote exchange of GDP with the GTP. So the GTP bond of the G alpha subunit then will separate from the receptor and also the beta gamma. So then they can, especially the GTP bond alpha and the beta gamma can interact with downstream effectors. Some of the downstream effector as well as some of the cellular protein has a GTPase activating activity which will stimulate the intrinsic GTPase activity of the G alpha subunit which will basically hydrolyze GTP. Then this G alpha subunit become a GDP bond G alpha subunit, and the GDP bond of G alpha subunit has a very high affinity for beta gamma subunit, so this will allow reassociation of alpha subunit with the beta gamma subunit. This process will go on and on as long as the receptor is ligated until the receptor is desensitized. So that means the receptor will be phosphorylated. This is one example. The receptor can be phosphorylated by a specific protein kinase. The phosphorylation will promote interaction with other other protein, which will basically shut down the signaling pathway.
This happens
to all the G-protein coupled signaling in general. That's just generically true. So this is the G-alpha subunit so far. People have been identified in the mammalian system. There are probably 16 G-alpha subunits. The chemoattractant receptor mainly coupled to those G-alpha subunits. There are many G-beta and gamma subunits as well. So they can combine with the G-alpha subunit to form a trimeric G-protein. So this is a list of effectors can be regulated by G alpha subunit or the beta gamma subunit in the mammalian system. For the case of chemoattractant mediated signal transduction, most of the signal is mediated by the beta gamma subunits. So in this talk, we're going to talk about the regulation of the PLC beta and PI3 kinase. And the role of these two pathways in regulation of chemotaxis. By the end of the talk, I hope I'm going to also convince you we have identified a new pathway which directly interact with the beta gamma and also play a very important role in regulation of chemotaxis.
In your movie, you were implying these G protein subunits are membrane bound.
Oh yeah, so this is basically the alpha subunit and the gamma subunit is not transmembrane protein but the membrane associated because they all modified with the lipid moiety. So that's why they stick to the membrane. It's about alpha and the gamma. Yeah. So they all membrane associated protein. So in this talk I'm going to basically try to tell you how the chemoattractant through a distinguished signaling pathway to regulate some biochemical and also cellular response elicited by a chemoattractant. And we have been focused on the two phospholipids. mediated signal transduction pathway. One is mediated production of PIP3, you have heard a lot about this, and another one mediated production for IP3 and diacylglycerol. So both enzymes use the same substrate as illustrated here. This is PIP2, this is a phospholipid, this is a fatty acid and triglycerol, and this is a sugar chain. This is there are already two phosphate groups on the 4,5 group. So what does the PI3K do, or the phosphoinositide 3 kinase does, is to phosphorylate the 3 position to add a 1 phosphate on the 3 position. So this becomes a PIP3. And why is so important? Because there are a number of proteins contain a protein domain called a plexstring homology domain, which specifically recognizes this PIP3. We need this phosphate at the 3 position. There are small G-protein exchange factor regulate the small GTP binding protein. There are a lot of protein kinases, probably this AKT protein kinases. Most people use the pitch domain from this protein kinase to trace the concentration of phospholipid. You're going to hear this more probably in Henry's talk and also in Rick's talk as well. So the phospholipase C, by contrary, they also basically hydrolyze the same substrate, the PIP2, by cleave this phosphoester bond to produce aqueous soluble IP3 and membrane bound diacylglycerol. This diffusible IP3 will bind to a calcium channel, will release calcium from intracellular pool, increase intracellular calcium concentration. So the diacylglycerol, membrane bound glycerol, will basically bind to activate a protein kinase, which can phosphorylate the target gene. So the problem, major problem, or the major complexity in the mammalian system is everything comes in as a family. So any enzyme, they're usually multiple isoforms encoded by different genes. For example, the PI3K, there are at least four members that's regulable by extracellular stimuli. And with regard to the phospholipase C, at least there are 10 members can be regulated. So what we try to determine is try to figure out which of this isoform is really responsible for chemoattractant mediated signal transduction in leukocyte. So we and the second goal is try to figure out which of those biochemical or the biological or the cellular response mediated by any of those pathways. So we use a method called gene targeting. We specifically knock out a gene in mouse, so this is a kind of mouse genetic approach. You're going to hear a lot of the genetic approach using in the, actually you already heard, the genetic approach in the DICTI, so they can make all kind of mutant. So in the mammalian system, the easiest way to make a hypomorph or the null allele is through this knockout approach. So basically, you introduce a mutation in the embryonic stem cell, mouse embryonic stem cell. Then you inject it into a foster embryo and implant to a normal foster female mouse, so they can produce a chimera by interbreeding them. Eventually, you're going to get a homozygous for the gene you disrupt. Then you need to confirm you indeed knock out that gene. So for example, we use Western analysis just to look at whether the protein still exists or not. So in the knockout mice, you don't see this protein anymore. So next important question is whether the isoform you knock out is really important in the leukocyte. It's really mediated the chemoattractive signaling, and that you need to do the biochemical assay to confirm that. So for different enzymes, you use different biochemical acids to do that. For example, if you want to look at the PI3K activity, That's the assay we use, is a thin layer chromatography. You extract the lipid and run on the thin layer chromatography. This is the PIP3. The rest are all the kind of lipid, but this is the PIP3 is very actually minor species for lipid. So in the wild type neutrophil, this is all neutrophil isolated from an animal. Okay, this is a wild type animal. If you stimulate the F-LuFe, you get a increase of PIP3, but in the PI3K gamma knockout, you don't see that. So that tells us that this is an important isoform. If you knock it out, you don't see a PIP3 production. So same thing we did with the 4-4 lipase. So we use Westin to confirm we really indeed generate a mutant mouse line that lacking a 4-4 lipase C, beta 2, beta 3, and we also can make a double knockout. Basically knock out two genes at the same time. That because knock out either one of these isoforms, you still see a residue activity. This is a 4-4 lipase C assay. It's used a different way to measure, different biochemical assay to measure this enzyme activity. This is all measurable. But if you knock out either the isoform, you still see a residue activity, but you have to knock out both to see completely elimination of the response.
Why do you call that complete elimination of responses? I'm trying to, I mean, it looks like it's gone down by a factor of two.
Right. No. Here. This is a double knockout.
You mean the difference between the signal and no signal?
Right. You're always at the basal level of something.
The basal level has changed a little bit.
Right.
So the difference in
the biology, this is probably a very clear-cut data already, but you probably don't get anything. the number is always relative.
Relative. It defines your zero. Is that what you're saying?
What we define as zero is compared with or without the chemoattractant. Not compared to this zero here.
Right. Yeah. So zero there just
That zero is right. Just to confuse the physicist.
Some basal activity and the
you're gonna have a basal level. The basal level could be the IP3 produced by other housekeeping 4-4 lipase C. Could be just degradation during your assay. And there is another way to measure 4-4 lipase C activity, look at intracellular calcium concentration. As I mentioned in the introduction, the 4-4 lipase IP3 regulate calcium concentration in the cell. So this zero I think will probably satisfy some of you. So you don't see a calcium change. This is a measure of delta calcium change.
So you're going to tell us the phenotypes of all these new?
Oh yeah. I just want to try to convince you the mutant we generate, knock out the pathway, the signaling pathway, we intend to knock out. So there's no more signaling. So whatever phenotype we observe from those mutant mice, well, you can basically see, okay, that's because you knock out that signaling pathway. I tried to basically lay this. Okay, now the phenotype, the chemotaxis. So initially we use a very primitive method to measure a chemotaxis. This is called Boyden chamber assay. This is probably the non-quantitative assay. Basically you have two chambers separated by a membrane with a pore on the membrane. You put a cell on top and a chemoattractant on the bottom, and the neutrophil will basically migrate through the pore and stick on the bottom of the membrane. You just count the number of cells at the bottom on the bottom of the membrane. So to our surprise that the PLC beta knockout, the double knockout, either show no response depending on which chemoattractant you use, or you see an enhancement of chemotactic activity. So the 4-4 lipase C or the calcium transient induced by this chemoattractant is not important for chemotaxis.
So this is completely analogous to what has been shown in dictyostelium, right?
Right.
Dictyostelium, there's a knockout of the IP3 receptor, which of course diminishes calcium response,
right.
And it does not seem to alter
chemo. Right. It's not a significant alter the chemo. So when we look at the PI3K gamma knockout, we see a consistent impairment. We see a reduction in chemotaxis activity. So now I think, based on the above data, I convince you that the, in the neutral field, the chemoattractant uses PI3K gamma to produce PIP3, and which has some role, which we're going to tell more about what exactly role, some kind of role in the chemotaxis. On the other hand, the same receptor also uses phospholipase C. Depending on which chemoattractant you look at, they may have an enhancement. That means if you knock out this, there's enhancement. That means normally this serves as an active feedback. Yes?
So in the ETF system, mm-hmm. in fibroblasts, PLC seems to be important because it's involved in the release of cofillin and severing and producing new ligands for actin polymerization. So you don't see any effect on that in the PLC.
No, not so. That's very surprising data for us. When we started to generate those knockout weeks, of course the hypothesis was we expect this thing should play an important role in chemotaxis. And I think there definitely there's a cell type dependency in terms of the importance of some of the signaling pathway.
Mm. First of all, when you talk about different isoforms,
mm-hmm.
is it generally the case that these isoforms have different functions in the cell? Beta, gamma, you know.
Some of the isoform may express in some cell but not the other cell. There are always probably more than one isoform expressing. In a given cell, but not always all the isoforms are going to express in the same cell. And most time, all those isoforms can carry out the same biochemical reaction, but we don't know about the kinetics. So maybe there is some of the isoform does better than other. We don't know. Yeah.
And the second is this Boyden chamber. What does it measure? It's a measure of the ability of the cells to.
And then the overall migration. So they won't tell you anything. Either quantitative or just qualitatively see whether you affect the migration. So that's why we have more detailed study here. So looking at a real migration of the cell using time-lapse video microscopy. So this is a wall-type neutral field. You're probably going to see more picture if Henry get here on time. But anyway, I will show you one. So this is a neutrophil move in the Zygmund chamber. So this is basically move, migrate under a shallow gradient, Zygmund chamber shallow gradient, along this direction. So that is a wall type of neutrophil moving that direction. Polarized, and sometimes the polarization maybe slow down a little bit, then start repolarize, form a new pseudopod and start to move again. So this is a PI3K deficient neutral field. For this cell, they don't really move along the gradient. This gradient is this direction, so they actually move in this direction. And you will see they form this kind, sometimes they form one pseudopod here, then they start to decide to move this direction, form another one, they go in that way. You see they form a lot of protrusion. And if you look at the wall type, generally the protrusion form and along the leading edge. So that's a clearly lack of directionality. And the neutrophil lacking PI3K gamma. So it suggests this is the PI3K gamma plays some kind of role. Then this is a summary of all the cells we look at. Okay, basically what we plot the cell, and we assume all these start from the same origin. And after 10 minutes, this is the position, relative position of the cell to the origin. Right? So the cell, this is a wild type cell. They generally move. This is a gradient along the the axis. So they generally move along this direction, but not all the cells end up. This is, I think, in a way, very similar to what Tobias showed you yesterday. So most of cells move in the general right direction. And this is without a gradient. And in the PI3K deficient cell, they move, they end up in all position relative to their initial starting point. So this is consistent with the video I showed, that they don't really know where to move, but they move. If you put in a, under a gradient, this is a shallow gradient, they move. You know, the motility is stimulated by the gradient, but they just don't know where they should.
What is this bullseye here?
That's basically tell you the directionality. That's the calculate the number of cell at a certain that, yeah, right, something like that. So,
so
mm.
Yeah,
no gradient.
So it looks like they don't move very much.
Right. Yeah, they don't move very much in neutral cell.
What?
You mean the as the wall type? You mean?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the water move more than the mutant? Yeah. So the cell, the probably because of the random migration, they are also doing the same thing. It's not stimulated, so they probably. See, if you look at the distance traveled by most of those mutants, so as the absolute distance is shorter, but that's because they're moving like this. Yeah.
And you do the more uniform, instead of a directional stimulus, you do a uniform stimulus. Do they have the same level of chemokinesis as wild-type cells? So will they move at the same speed even though there is some directionality?
Okay, that's all gonna show you in the next. So we summarize this data using a computer software, and basically we, we trace each of the points, the motility movement of the each cell, and then we summarize this in a quantitative way. So basically, for the majority of the wild-type cell, which eventually going to move towards the right direction. So what the way we call the right direction is anything on the right side of the y-axis. Yeah. So majority of the cell located after 10 minutes on the right side of the y-axis. But for the mutant cell, you see only about 60% of cell on the right side. But remember that if for any random movement, you get a 50% cell move on the right side of y-axis anyway. So there, clearly there's a significant difference. So this is the motility rate we traced. We basically take a picture every 5 seconds. That's based on the divided by the 5 seconds, that's what we got. They're slightly slower, but not much, not that significant, let me see. That's probably because they sometimes they form multiple protrusions, so they have a opposite effect, sense of direction, probably, that they slow down them.
So the answer to Rick's question is the chemokinesis is more or less the same.
More or less the same, yeah. More or less.
Yeah, so it does move in response to a constant stimulation, more or less the same as wild type. It's just missing the direction.
Right. Actually, this is under the gradient, so it's not in a uniform. We didn't look at it under uniform.
You didn't look, okay, yeah. But if it's moving in random directions,
right,
it probably would be the same when you...
Right. So basically what the movement of the mutant cell is regarded as the gradient. So it's in a way probably similar to... But they cannot sense the gradient anyway.
Right.
To the PR3K knockout cell, this with or without gradient, maybe the...
Wait, lost. So the one on the right is under uniform or no?
No, no, this is all the... All this data is summarized from the...
It's with a shallow
from
gradient.
From a shallow gradient, the Zygmunt chamber stuff,
so
yeah.
The assumption is it's just chemokinesis due to the constant background level. That's all I understood.
So as shown in the movie, the mutant cell make very frequent direction change, and they form multiple protrusion. So this is all statistical. It's not only happened to that cell. I show you when we found this rather consistently. Okay, so then we look at a distribution of the protein in those in those neutrophils. At that time, I mean, the when we start to look at this, at that time, the a number of lab, it's including Peter's, Rick, and also Henry's lab, they show the some of the protein, especially the pH domain containing protein, can polarize in the chemotactic cell. So then we look at what happened to the pH domain containing protein. This is the AKT, which contains a pH domain. How these proteins distribute in the mouse neutrophil. And we cannot look at the live translocation of those GFP pH domains shown in the previous, I think, the number of talks showed. I used that as an example because we look at the primary neutrophil. It's hard to transfect, and they have very short lifetime. So what we did is we just fixed the cell and stain, use immunostaining, use antibody and look at it. But we basically observe the same phenotype. So this is a wine neutrophil. This is observed on the confocal microscope. This is an optical slice. So we will see this AKT mainly localized at the leading edge of the of a chemotactic cell. This is the direction of a gradient. This is the cell basically undergoing chemotaxis in the Zygmund chamber in the shallow gradient. And also the F-actin that's polymerized, the actin colocalized with AKT at the leading front has been shown by many other groups. So these are two independent cells. But if you look at the PI3K deficient neutrophil, you see the actin and the AKT no longer polarize, and the cell may have some poor spontaneous polarization. If you look at it, maybe there's more concentrated actin on the one end of the cell. This is the direction of a gradient. But the AKT and actin no longer overlap as in the wild type. So
that cell moving down to the left?
That what we assume because we cannot look at a live picture. We have to fix. I mean, but this very mimic basically the cell moving to that direction. We cannot tell for sure. Yes, yes. Actually, if you look carefully, there is the actin and basically is in the lamina podium, and the AKT is some kind of behind it. So it's not really on the membrane, although there is a concentration of AKT somewhere, but all with the not overlap with the. There's a poor overlapping between these two molecules. So the cell is overall is less polarized. If you look at the wild type cell, most of those proteins are concentrated at the leading edge, but those, you see a lot of the either AKT or F-actin distributed in the other part of the cell.
So is this due to this, with neutrophils, you generally have a very big and wide lamella podia, and it's deep.
Mm-hmm. Thick. Right.
The back of the cell is much thinner. Mm-hmm. So is this due to the fact that what you're predominantly looking at is the issue that Tobias mentioned yesterday? Yeah. You're looking at basically cytosolic localization?
That, yeah, we don't know whether this is on the membrane or not. We don't know. Although this is a confocal sectioning, okay. So, but this, if you look at the cell, the edge of the membrane, this the actin probably some of the F actins may be localized very near to the membrane or on the membrane. But definitely, this probably is not really on the membrane.
You just have a GFP, how would that look?
We don't know. We never put a GFP in those primary neutrophil. This is a primary neutrophil.
That you're seeing
right, this is only in the mutant only. But I think the conclusion is that the PR3K is somehow important for maintain a very stable polarization. Maybe the cell still can move, and if the cell can move, there got to be a leading edge, right? And the leading edge is definitely not as good as the wild type, and the AKT is not really at the right location. Maybe that explains why the PR3K deficient mice cannot move with a certain directionality.
Could you explain why you show four pictures? What does one conclude from four pictures and one couldn't conclude from one picture?
Which one? Here?
This time.
This is a confocal optical section. So this is the same cell, and we're looking at different level of the cell from the ventral to dorsal. You can make draw the conclusion just from a single picture.
Not more information.
No, this is a fixed cell.
Yes, yeah, they're not moving, so you could use a photon.
No. No, this is not a live cell. This is a dead cell.
Yeah. So that means you can really do things because you can I'm just wondering whether you've got a real photon section instead of a confocal section.
This is very, the neutral field, this is a single cell and the chamber is not that thick. So I don't really see why the two photon here will give you more information than.
Because you were collecting my photon.
Okay. Oh, this is all after 10 minutes in the chamber. Okay, this is all, at least for the wild type, is well polarized. So most of the cell in the chamber are well polarized if you let it go for 10 minutes. Okay, so based on this data, we believe the PR3K is involved in the basically directionality, so they determine the direction where the cell should move, and clearly see a very poor polarization in the cell lacking PR3K gamma. So however, neither the deficiency of PR3K gamma or the PLC significantly affect acting formation. At least this enzyme does not really change much of acting polymerization. This is similar to what Rick observed in the DICTI, when you knock out PR3K and DICTI. This is basically use fluorescence labeled fluoridine, which specific bind to the F acting. You just fix the cell, permeabilize, and stain with the fluoridine. Then you do a flow analysis. They'll tell you, yeah. But this is basically fluorescence intensity. If you add ligand, you get an increase of fluorescence intensity, and then it doesn't change much if you compare different genotype. The small G protein play a very important role. The monomeric G protein, the difference is from the heterotrimeric G protein. I show you this is only one subunit which. But only like the GFR subunit has GTP selective bind GTP, but it does not have beta gamma subunit associated. And some of those small G protein have been shown by many labs play a very important role in F acting or the cytoskeleton reorganization, F acting formation or localization. So we look at whether this deficiency or the knockout of those signaling pathway had any effect on the small G protein. So consistent with what I showed in the previous slide, the RAC, which I think believe is involved in F acting formation, it's not activation of this small G protein is not affected. And we also look at a CDC42, the PR3K deficiency does not affect the CDC42 activation. So we have a way to look at the active CDC42 by Weston.
It looked like there might have been a quantitative difference in the
PR3K. No. You mean this one?
Not an active polarization RAC.
The RAC is decreased,
though,
is it?
It's very hard to see. I wouldn't say there is a statistically significant change. It's hard because of those mass neutrophil assay are rather variable. But look at all the experiments we did. We cannot draw a conclusion whether there is a minor effect on the RAC activation or not.
It's not 50%.
Not 50%, right. Maybe there's 20%, 10%, I don't know. Our error rate probably is like 30%.
And what
with this kind of acid.
What about CDC-42?
The same kind of deal. Yeah. So this kind of acid is it's not highly quantitative. Unless there are some really major, more than 50% reduction, so very hard, especially with
time. So that means second. So that's a time course.
Here.
Well, the previous graph.
Yeah, that's a time course. So there's a rapid
time after treatment with
the ligand, whichever chemotherapy you use.
And so RAC activation.
Very fast, then come back. So if you actually there's still a little bit, and it's not come back to the base. So basically, like you come up a big peak, then come back to a plateau, which is still higher than. Then the basal, then the plateau will last for a couple of minutes. And this is, we also look at a kinase called PAC kinase with a known effect for both CDC42 and the RAC. There's a small G-protein can activate this kinase, so the PI3K deficiency does not affect the kinase activity either. So all this evidence consistent tell us that the PI3K deficiency does not significantly regulate those pathways, either the RAC or CDC42. There may be a modulatory effect, but not the one really upstream of those small G protein. Okay, this is basically the summary. So neither pathway is really have a very strong effect on the small G protein regulation. And so what we think, there got to be a more direct pathway from the beta gamma to small G protein. So how the small G protein regulated? So when we mention small G protein here, we generally refer to the Rho family of small G protein. There are three members in this family: Rho, RAG, and CDC42. There's a monomeric protein. They all modify with the lipid moiety at the end of the protein, and that's why they stick to the membrane. They activated by the exchange factor, guanine nucleotide exchange factor. Those protein basically promote exchange of GTP with GDP with GTP. So this exchange factor in a way resemble the ligated receptor I talked for the heterotrimeric G protein. So their role is just to promote nucleotide exchange. So GTP bond of a small G protein, the active G protein, they can, all these three members are known to regulate or to form or modulate acting structure.
So these things all have pH domains?
There's I list a few. There are probably 60 of those.
60.
Yeah, 60. Yeah. I listed a few well-known, well-studied.
Yeah, but the naive hypothesis of saying you need the PI3 kinase to change the membrane, would track these factors to interact with those, is wrong.
It's wrong?
Because, that naive hypothesis is wrong, because you said the CDC42 activation and actin
or whatever
does not depend on...
Okay, so you're gonna find out this, at the end of the talk, I hope I'll convince you that probably the activation of this small G protein is not important. The PI3K, the PIP3, may not be important for the activation, but it's important for localization.
For recruitment, pH domain refers to a type of protein chart, some of which bind the products of PI3K, some of which do not. There's a little bit of discrepancy in the literature, but I think a large number of people do not believe that most of the chain factors, the pH domain does not bind lipid. Now, there are a couple, like P-Rex up there, has another pH domain, and it is an effector of PI3 kinase. However, most of them do not. So the fact that it has a pH domain, we should not translate as being a binder of
PIP3.
Really? Okay.
I agree with Rick. They're actually the big family of those kind of domain. There are different specificity for the phospholipid.
Just to clarify, you said it is not important in activating.
I'll show you. So I think this is probably a very good example how we. I think I was asked a question about how we really start working, how we basically identify the path we want to work on, and how we characterize the pathway, a signaling pathway. and how we do the educated guess how what may be important and what may be relevant to the chemoattractant signaling. So this is how we initially identified the identify a new signaling pathway. So the as I mentioned, that PAC can be actually previously had been identified to characterized to be activated by chemoattractant receptor. So neither of the PI3K or phospholipase C regulate this kinase. So we think probably there is a distinct pathway can regulate this kinase. So we basically try to see how this kinase is activated with this transfector pack and beta gamma, which is the first activator in this signaling pathway. We see whether the beta gamma can directly activate the pack. We transfect this into the cell. What we found, you see a little bit activation. Right? However, if we threw in a number of other components into the system, like CDC42 and the PIX as an exchange factor.
What cells are these?
This is in the Cas7 cell. Yeah, this is a reconstitution. So we first try to reconstitute whether, first of all, to demonstrate whether this can activate. Then we, using genetic approach, go back to the neutrophil to confirm whether this is really occur and what's the biological role of this pathway really. Really plays in the chemoattractant mediated signal transduction. So that's basically the way we, my lab, have been working on those signaling pathway. So at least in the Cas7 cells, if you throw in those components, you can really activate this kinase. So this kinase activation depends on both the exchange factor, CDC42. You throw in any one of them, and you don't get the full activation only when you add all of them. You see. And also, beta gamma can, in the same cell, can activate the CDC42 if you throw in PIX. And surprisingly, you had to also add PEC into this system to get a full activation of CDC42. Finally, we can demonstrate that beta gamma can bind to PEC directly. This is a cool IP. It's not really a good evidence for direct interaction. We also have evidence to use recombinant protein purified from bacteria to demonstrate that the beta gamma and PEC can directly interact. So based on those data, we hypothesized that when ligand bind to the receptor, release the beta gamma, which recruit the PEC and the PIX. The PECs and the PICs, they form a constitutive dimer that has been demonstrated by other lab previously. So this the direct interaction between beta, gamma, and the PEC will recruit the PEC and PICs heterodimer to the cell surface. Since the DH domain can activate, have been shown, the number of labs show that the PICs can activate the CDC42. And it also previously shown by other labs, the CDC42 can activate PEC. So we think this is how the chemoattractant may activate a PEC and a CDC42 that may eventually downstream signaling. So since we characterize on this whole hypothesis based on our observation in the Cas7 cells, so we need to really confirm this is indeed occurs in the myeloid or in the neutrophil or the we try to demonstrate the PECs indeed required. Okay, the PEC here is indeed required for the chemoattractant mediated activation of CDC42. So we use a approach called RNAi. This is a new technology developed in the past two years. This allow us in the mammalian cells to consistently knock down the expression of whatever gene you want. This technology was not available 3 years ago. So at that time, the best way to do to knock down protein is using gene targeting or use pharmacological means.
Down 40%, 37%.
Yeah, so we use a vector-based RNAi. So we basically, this approach is a vector-based. We have a vector, we made a stable cell line. We have two clones here. One probably knocked down 60%, another one knocked down about 80%. This is probably 80, this is 60%. And when we look at the CDC42 activation by chemoattractant, in the, this is HL60 cell, what we found that this line showed consistent less activation. And interestingly, knockdown of PEC does not affect the REC activation. And this is a total cell protein as a control. So we identified a specific pathway that specifically regulate the activation of CDC42. And what's the role of PEC in the chemotaxis? So in this is, I only showed data from one of the line we have. So it's very similar to what I showed for the PI3K gamma knockout. So they just basically lose the directionality. And it does not affect the motility rate much, but they lose the directionality. They look not much different from the wild type cell. Then we, next step, we try to prove the PIX is important, since the PIX is the exchange factor. And we use the good old method, the knockout. So we generate a PIX deficient mouse line, and we isolate the neutrophil, and we look at the PEC activation. So the PEC activation, especially the initial PIX, of PEC activation is dependent on PIX.
Well, previously you had showed that the PI3 kinase pathway and the CDC42 pathway were distinct,
mm-hmm.
right? They're just two separate things that some maybe...
The activation is distinct, right?
Right, mm-hmm. But then you wind up with the same phenotype.
Right, let me tell. We'll have more coming.
Okay.
So that eventually going to link those together.
Okay.
And the PIX is important for CDC42 activation. So there's no PIX deficient cell. This two-length PIX deficient cell. There's no active CDC42. I didn't have data here, but it does not affect the REC activation. It's important. So it does not affect the actin polymerization. It's a time course for actin polymerization. There's no difference in magnitude or the time course. So what happened to the PIX knockout? Same phenotype. So that further support our idea of the PIX packing in the same pathway. Yeah. Okay, important all this, the CDC42 pack as well as G beta gamma can be localized at the leading edge of a polarized cell. This is the cell in the shallow gradient, the Degenman chamber, after 10 minutes. So this is a very polarized cell. They all colocalize with F actin. So the G beta can colocalize with the actin. So the G beta is polarized, like actually previously shown by Peter's lab. May not be as this drastic, but in the Dictus staining, apparently the beta gamma distribution and the polarized cell may be also polarized. So the CDC42 is polarized, the distribution of the protein, it's not active protein, the total protein. And the PEC, so they can all localize the leading edge, so that at least support this protein can really stay together in a real neutrophil. That's three different cells, we only can stain two things. We always co-stain with F actin, use F actin as a reference mark. So that's to indicate they all localize their leading edge. This is a distribution of F actin for the cell undergoing chemotaxis in the Zygmunt chamber. So you see the F actin mainly localized in the front, and we also look at where is the active CDC42. Instead of looking at total, we also look at active. We use the CBD, which is active CDC42 binding protein. So you see also a leading edge specific staining of the CBD. I don't see much of staining in the PIX because there's you don't have a CDC42 activation in the PIX deficient cell. And this is pretty weak, and the actin is rather diffused. Although there's maybe still some kind of gradient in the cell, but it's very diffused in the PIX deficient cell. It's in a way very similar to the PI3K. Now we did to try to, so it's clearly the PIX pack and involved in the directionality of the movement, and they probably important for maintain a stabilized polarity or the polarization in the cells undergoing chemotaxis in the shallow gradient. Now we look at what happens if we do acute treatment to see the initial the polarization process. So we want to see whether the cells still have the ability to sense direction. So what we did, we basically use many other labs like Henry's lab and Peter's use and Rick's lab use a micropipette. We just treat this, put a cell, put a micropipette with at one side of the cell and puff chemoattract to the cell, and for those images we fix the cell 30 seconds after a treatment. And for the wild type cell you see and the pipette always on this at this direction. So you see a polarized or asymmetrical distribution for F-actin on the one side of the cell and towards the pipette. But in the PR3K you see although also asymmetric distribution, but the depend on which cell you look at, this concentrated localized can be anywhere. It's irrelevant to the position of micropipette.
And would you get the same if you didn't impose gradient?
Right. If you give a uniform treatment, it's very similar to a uniform treatment. So if you give the wild type a uniform treatment, basically that's what you see.
Yeah.
Oh, this is actin, F-actin, Floydian, F-actin. So the PIX give a similar kind of phenotype, but much broader edge. So we also, this is an example cell. So we basically divide the cell into three parts, and then we calculate the PIX cell from each part, and calculate the percentage of each area, and try to get some statistic. I think people working with image know, and you can always find any image you like. So we try to always get some statistics. Yeah.
I was just wondering, this type of experiment, usually how many cells do you
look at? We look at over 50 cells. So this is the data compiled from the 50 cells. Yeah. So you see in the wild type, definitely in the A quadrant, you see more pixel than the rest, and in the these two knockout, you don't really see a statistically significant more or more of a distribution of F-actin in any of the quadrant. So, and we also look at active CD42, it's a similar phenotype. You see the active CD42 in the PR3K deficient, they show an asymmetric distribution, but where they localize is irrelevant to the position of pipette. This is a statistic. Okay, it's important is even though in the PR3K deficient cell, those localization is random. But the affecting always stay together with active CDC42, no matter where you go. This is a PI3K deficient cell, and same thing. So, no matter where you concentrate, always the co-localize. So, what we think here is how you can link PI3K and CDC42 together. What we think is the chemoattractant to use this mechanism, as I described in the previous slide, to activate this pathway, but you need this to localize this pathway to leading edge. And this is probably, the activation of this probably is not really significantly dependent on PIP3, maybe there's a modulated effect. But the localization definitely depends on this. So that's basically tell you where this whole machinery tell you where you should polarize your F-actin. Although this pathway does not stimulate F-actin polarization itself. to tell you where it should polarize. Because if you knock out this pathway, it's still polarized. X-acting still polarized, just polarized at the wrong location.
So FIP3 recoups, I guess, and other gets to the place where the active polymerization takes place. And what about CBC42 and FAC? What brings them over to, how do they assemble together? Are they also recruited by some interactions?
Beta binds PAC. That's what I showed in the previous slide. Beta binds PAC directly.
Does CDC42 also localize in the
lamellar cone? Yeah, eventually. If you look at a polarized cell, the CDC42 will be polarized. You have a higher concentration of CDC42 in the polarized cell. And if you, in a naive cell, they probably distribute all over the cell.
Yet, the argument is that beta gamma brings
PIX
in to activate the GDP bound form.
Mm-hmm.
Via PAC.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it looks like to me there's a sort of a circular argument here. That, and how does it work? Beta gamma binds PAC.
Binds the PAC.
A GDP or anything.
Right.
And then PAC is bound to PIX.
Right.
Now, beta-gamma, therefore, has localized already to the membrane.
Beta-gamma, right. Activity beta-gamma should be on the membrane, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the PIX is also, there also should be a little bit more of it at the front. You're saying the PIP3 helps to accentuate that.
Right.
Now, the CBC42 gets a GTP on it. What do you think that does to the PAC brain? See, the... is the CBC42 bound to the PAC before it gets a GTP on it, or after? When does this happen?
That should be after.
But you said that you didn't get a GTP on it without having the PAC around.
No.
I can't remember that.
Okay.
You had a funny thing where you couldn't get a pull down something without having the PAC present.
This one?
Yes, now is that right? You couldn't get activation of CDC42. Is that right?
Right. You couldn't get a significant activation of CDC42. So what we think here is the PAC has a dual rule here. So PAC has dual rule. One is the PAC is the effector of a GTP bond of CDC42. So PAC also have a role which probably similar to the FAR1P or the STE5 in the East, which is the scaffold protein, which direct binds to the beta gamma. So basically what we think is that the PAC here has maybe also serve as a scaffold protein that brings the PICs to this signaling complex. Then the PICs will activate CDC42, the active CDC42 will activate and binds and activate the PAC.
When you do a collide on the PAC,
you're doing a PAC, the PAC is in the form or in the form. In other words, it's active on the active. If in absence of the PICs or CDC42, if you just do a simple beta gamma and a PAC, so the PAC is, when we look at activity, okay, there's no activity, very low activity. So we assume probably, we never look at whether it's a dimer or monomer, we assume probably it's a dimer form, because dimer is the inactive form.
So you are saying that there are some opportunities to recruit an inactive form
of
PAC, and waiting for
CD42 to activate them. Right.
What will happen? Because without PAC, it will become a monomer,
that's the idea. Mm-hmm. And you're right, that may be dissociated. After they activate the PAC may be dissociated from this. I mean, there's also previous evidence to show that once the PAC is auto-phosphorylated, the affinity for CDC42 was reduced. maybe that maybe going to reduce, and then the probably diffuse. So they had to release the CDC-42 and for the downstream effect as well. Otherwise, the CDC-42 will be occupied by the PEG. So we don't know exactly what which one, the CDC-42 or PEG or both, maybe transduce signal for them, because CDC-42 has independent effect as well, not only PEG, there are other effects as well. On what? On the activation?
Yeah.
Right. If you remove the pitch domain, if you remove the pitch domain, then you kill all the activity. Kill the basically beta gamma media activation.
You kill all.
Right. And if you throw in more PI3K by co-expressively activated form PI3K, you can stimulate a little bit, not much. So in terms of activation. So we think probably PR3K has some effect on modulated activity, but not the essential part. But it's important for probably because the way we look at the costin, it's important for localization. Okay, I think I'd like to basically that's what we think. So the PIP3 will help localize where this thing is activated, which is this pathway will eventually localize where its affecting should be localized. And for the actin formation, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the RAC. That's important. I think Henry has some data just published on JCB, so the RAC is also important. And actually, our PAC knockout, the PIX knock, the chemotactic behavior, very similar to what Henry showed for the using domain negative CDC42 and CBD. He was just very. I think it's all consistent in terms of what this pathway can do for chemotaxis.
So let me ask a question about these two parallel pathways. Mm-hmm. So there, it seems to me there are two logical possibilities. Either the pathway on the left does gradient sensing, puts a localized PIP3 on the membrane, and then interacts with CDC42, mm-hmm. PAC, whatever, to then control actin polymerization based on that previous localization. Or the other possibility is you need this other pathway, the central pathway, also mm-hmm. to stabilize the localization part. Now, the evidence you presented seemed like the latter was true, at least in neutrophils. Mm-hmm.
I think those pathways interact with each other. It's not simply just one and act independent.
So
I think Henry has a lot of data suggests those like the formation of F actin maybe have a like positive feedback on where. Maybe the localization on the PIP3, I think he's going to talk about more about that. And I think all these, maybe all these different pathways. And also, I think another important thing is what we describe here is not really describe the whole control and the whole regulatory pathway to control the directionality or the direction sensing. This will probably just only look at a small part of a big
right.
picture.
But in particular, mm-hmm. if I understood your graphs, you showed that in the PIX knockout or whatever, when you interfered
right.
in a variety of ways of interfering with
right.
the central
mm-hmm.
pathway,
mm-hmm.
you saw no remnant at all left of the ability to do gradient sensing. Not a question mm-hmm. of directional motion, but even just sensing and
all this destroy the basically the gradient sensing, the direction sensing, right?
Right.
I mean that's basically I think Harry gonna talk about that in the CDC42 and it's very consistent. And I think this will have an effect on the stabilization, the permanent polarization. Maybe cell has a different mechanism for or there's a probably intrinsic ability to form like a primitive polarization as what Tobias described yesterday. And this pathway just tried to either direct the polarization and strengthen it. Okay.
Sorry, what
You can ignore that part. That's important. That's not important. So I'd like the knowledge of people who have been involved in this. We've been working on these three pathways for the past almost 10 years. So we can probably disappoint with the efficiency of the biological research, and on the other hand, we can appreciate the difficulty. So there are current and the past associate in my lab have been contributed to a different part of this work. Thank you very much.
Yeah, one or two couple more questions, then we'll take a break afterwards.
Yeah, do you think it is qualitatively different in dictyostelium, where PAC appears to be as far away from the leading edge as it can be?
I discussed this with Rick yesterday, and I think there are six isoforms in mammalian cells, and the first three PAC contains the peak binding domain. So the PAC characterized by Rick's lab, we call PAC1A, does not contain the peaks domain. I don't even know whether there is a peaks in a but on the other hand, if you look at the pathway I described, in a way reminiscent to what in the East what happened. In the East, there's a scaffold protein, there's CDC4, there's a CDC24, which is exchange factor. And the exchange factor binds to the scaffold protein. The beta gamma binds the scaffold protein. Beta gamma direct binds to the PAC in the East. So probably in the neutral field, the PAC will be served at both the scaffold protein and a downstream target. That's a good question. You need to somehow distribute that. You have to control distribution for that PAC somehow. If you put a pitch domain, and that may be doable, but we haven't done anything. But that's probably a good idea. You put a pitch domain and treat the cell with a chemotractin, then you move PAC to a. Right? But you have to do it in a mutant cell to do it.